What actually provides creative destruction to an economy as it's going through this phase transition? It's a new form of money. It's a new form of money that actually has scarcity built into it that can't be manipulated. Because when it arrives, what it does is it takes the credit market that has been totally mutilated and manipulated for decades on end, and it smashes it with a sledgehammer.
I think that the world has already began a transition from an era of abundance to an era of scarcity. That's why it's kind of comical in how the Fed is responding and trying to combat inflation, because everything they're doing is trying to reduce inflation by reducing demand. But to really, that's putting a Band-Aid on a patient that needs surgery.
What's up, Sats fans? Welcome to Swan Signal. My name is Sam Callahan. I am your host today. If you care about your financial future, you need to check out a couple of our offerings, including Swan IRA and Swan Private. Swan Private is our white glove concierge service where you get a trusted partner on your Bitcoin journey. We offer all kinds of education and research projects, as well as exclusive events to our Swan Private customers. Check it out today at swan.com/private. Also, Swan IRA. Swan IRA is the best way to gain exposure to real Bitcoin in a tax advantage account, like a traditional IRA, a Roth IRA, or rolling over your 401k. So if that interests you, check it out at swan.com/IRA today. We got an exciting show for you guys today. We got Mr. James Davalos, who's the co-portfolio manager of the Horizon Kinetics Inflation Beneficiaries ETF. Welcome, James. And we have Preston Pish, the co-founder of the Investors Podcast Network, a regular here and advisor at Ego Death Capital. Welcome, guys. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us. Excited to be here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us, Sam.
Of course. Well, Preston, you're kind of a regular, as I said, so listeners already know who you are. But James, this is your first time on Swan Signal. So why don't you introduce yourself and maybe let us know a little bit about the work you guys are doing over at Horizon Kinetics.
Sure. So I'm James Davalos. I'm PM, as you mentioned, of the Inflation Beneficiaries Fund, which was the first ETF launch at Horizon Kinetics, where I've actually worked since 2005. Came right out of undergrad and worked for Peter Doyle, Murray Stahl, Steve Bregman, and they're best known for doing really deep, I call it contrarian, non-consensus type of research. So we're not the type of firm that's just going to get a sell-side research report and go out and buy Google or something like that. We do, you know, roll up our sleeves. Sometimes we get ourselves into, you know, sticky situations, but I think that's the way to really get make differentiated returns. But, you know, Murray is the CIO, and I credit a lot of the work and success of the firm to him, obviously. And his name is thrown in the same circles as Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, kind of disciples of Graham and Dodd. And so he definitely caught a lot of people's attention for two reasons. One, he's a Graham and Dodd value guy. Two, he's one of the few guys, or at least 5-7 years ago, maybe the only people over the age of 50 that was actually in the crypto space. But when he started talking about crypto and Bitcoin, it definitely got a lot of people's attention. And then kind of as it relates to me personally, many of the same reasons why we're constructive on crypto and Bitcoin are synonymous with why we launched a inflation targeting ETF. And obviously, that's really resonated with the investment community, where we've only launched it about 2 years ago. We're about $1.3 billion in assets, and we think we're doing interesting things and definitely entering a new world and a new investment landscape that requires different types of thinking.
Yeah, and Murray came on my radar a few years ago when I heard him on Grant Williams' podcast, and he was talking about Bitcoin, and I was like, wow, this guy's very smart, and he understands Bitcoin. He understands Bitcoin mining. He understands the value proposition here. But let's talk about this macroeconomic landscape these days, because it's pretty confusing, honestly. That's how I would describe it. You know, some people are saying that we're going to have no landing and things are going to just truck along swimmingly. Others are predicting that we're about to have a massive collapse. You know, it just feels like we're in the eye of a storm. And so I'd like to just start and just ask both of you, how are you viewing the global macroeconomic economy and financial markets more broadly today? Like, I'll throw it to you, Preston, and then I'll get James's thoughts.
I think people have to start with the idea, if credit markets, bond markets around the world, the yields keep going higher, what does that actually mean? Because that's what we're seeing. And in February here, you're seeing a swift sell-off continue with yields going higher. And so you have to ask yourself, where's that buying power going? If people are selling bonds, they're either holding that in cash or they are buying something like equities or commodities. They have to do something with that selling. And I think that's the question. So if bond markets continue to sell off, and it looks like they just can't stop selling off because inflation prints over in Europe and inflation prints here in the US aren't really kind of settling down, where does that buying power go? And the irony, and I think the thing that's really hard for people to chew on as they're thinking about that, is they're looking at equities and they're saying, well, with higher rates, it's harder for them to produce profits, and it's harder to buy equities when their profit margins aren't as high, and you're looking at it that way, right? But I think you're in a situation that's very different than anything that we've seen in our lifetimes. Where you're dealing with a stable currency around the world that you can perform these economic calculations with interest rates continuing to gradually go down and not aggressively moving these big giant whipsaws. So that's the reason why I think everybody's confused, is because you're seeing an environment where, and remember, interest rates are the keystone of economic calculation. And if they're bouncing all over the place, that's the reason why people are having such a hard time of knowing what's coming next, how it's going to arrive, and how you can possibly perform economic calculation in an environment where interest rates are whipsawing like this. So I guess with all of that, I think that people are going to be surprised with how equities actually perform, risk on assets, because for a company that can remain profitable in this type of environment, I think they're going to get bid because they perform like a scarce commodity, or a scarce, call it Bitcoin, which has scarcity built into it. These things that are scarce, in order for an equity to be purchased that way, they have to be remaining profitable. Because if they're not profitable, the company's going to debase the number of shares in order to stay pro, because they have to fundraise somehow. So they're going to do that. They're going to borrow. They're going to do these things, and they're going to get crushed. They're not going to perform like a profitable business will. So people are going to really have to change the way they think about investing, because this type of environment is nothing like they've seen in their life.
James, got anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of scarcity. I think that the world has already began a transition from an era of abundance to an era of scarcity. And this could be a conversation for hours in and of itself, but just to go back to Preston's point on interest rates, markets, the one thing that markets hate is uncertainty. If you tell people earnings are going to go down 50% and then we're going to reset and then we're going to grind our way back, you can put that into Excel and you can figure out what the NPV is on an asset. But that uncertainty is what really sends markets into a tailspin. And when we were at 0%, the big word that Preston kept saying was profit. No one cared about profit. Think about how many profitless tech companies were trading at 30, 40, 50, 60 times sales and were burning hundreds of millions of dollars of cash flow a year. When the risk-free rate is zero, you can get away with that. When the risk-free rate is approaching 4, 5, like, forget about all the conjecture about whether we're going to cut or not. If we stay somewhere 3 to 5% in terms of rates, that old free money just bid up stuff into oblivion because one day they might magically be profitable is over. So I think the theme for this year is going to be profits and profit margins, because everyone can raise revenues in the first innings of inflation. You see in the newspaper, inflation's up, consumers have stimulus checks, everyone's doing fine, raise prices, your revenue goes up, but your cost of goods sold and your SG&A, so your expense items, they lag. So that's what I think is going to be the biggest theme for this year and next, is what business models can actually maintain or grow profit margins. And I think they're going to be a lot more rare than people think, but those that can will absolutely get bid.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, it seems like we got two value guys here, and it seems like now's the time to could find some value. I mean, the 6-month T-bill is yielding 5% now, and the S&P 500 earnings yield is a little bit over 5%. That's the narrowest spread since 2001. And so what do you guys look for when you're, if you're trying to find value? I mean, for the regular investor, it seems like you'd have to know what you're doing to look for a business that's actually profitable and could have a competitive moat and survive in this environment. So what kind of businesses are you guys looking at that have value in today's environment? Either one can.
You got to start with the thing that you said there, competitive moat. And you got to look at what those margins are, how they're going to be able to protect it against other businesses that are competing against them. You start there. You look for companies that actually produce profits, because in this environment, if you're not profitable, the days of 0% bid it to the moon, it doesn't really matter whether they make money or not, is over. And even though they're continuing to debase fiat like crazy around the world, all that fiat that's being added into the system, whether it's happening here in the United States or it's happening in Europe or whoever's turn it is to be debasing at a breakneck pace, the flows of those funds are going to flow into businesses that make money and aren't debasing their shares or adding more shares. Those are the things that are going to get bid. If you're a company that can't remain profitable, I think you're going to get wrecked in this environment. I don't think that this environment is going to change much as far as the inflationary impact and the higher interest rates. So you might want to start figuring out a way that if you price your equity, so you go through economic calculation with the equity, right? And you go there and you make a conservative estimate of what those free cash flows are. Then you look at the price of that company on the market. If it's not beating 5%, then what the hell are you doing owning it, right? If it's not beating 7 or 8%, what the hell are you doing owning it? Because you need to get some type of premium above quote unquote risk-free rates. And that would be for a US-based company that I'm using just dollar terms, right? So I think that the insanity that we saw for really since the 08 crisis in this deeply misconstrued quantitative easing environment that persisted for a decade, it is over. People need to actually wake up and perform economic calculation and do things in a way that is, it's not even hard what I'm describing. This is just the basics, right? Like, you have to do that with the basics. And then you have to do it with a company that you think can sustain that moat and can sustain those cash flows for 5 or 10 years. And you're getting those 7 or 8% yields based off of current prices. So that's how I would be looking at it if I was in equity, if I was a guy wanting to buy equity. I'm not. I'm a guy who loves buying as much Bitcoin as I possibly can, because I think the world's going to move to a real economic unit of account. And, you know, if a company like Michael Saylor's MicroStrategy can remain profitable, protect their competitive moat, and you get really good prices on it, and they're denominating their retained earnings in Bitcoin, well, then maybe I'll buy that type of equity. But there's not too many of those companies today. So, you know, I just continue to buy Bitcoin.
Yeah. And just one of the biggest differentiators of what Preston was just talking about is that he cares about what company he's buying, and B, he cares about how much profit they're generating. That has been the anathema of what the entire financial service industry has promoted for the better part of 20 years, because they've said, no, go indexed. BlackRock, iShares, State Street, Spiders, all of that, where you are being told it does not matter what these companies do or what they make. Just go into these indices. They're magical. They're no cost, and you're going to do great with beta. Game over now with where interest rates are and where the current economic landscape. So starters, you got to actually pay attention to what the companies do and what their valuations are, then to go to the moat. So that's probably one of the hardest things to determine in this business, is to really identify that moat. Is it properly priced in, especially when you're going out 5, 7, 10, 15 years? I mean, sure, maybe some people that know the industry a lot better than I would say the iPhone and iPads and AirPods are unassailable. There's no way they're going away. But I don't know. Who knows if there's going to be another technology that's going to kind of erode maybe their profit margins, if not their market share. One area that I think is a great place to start for a moat is we've focused, again, for 20, 30, 40 years on businesses and scalability, and most of it really revolves around technology and platforms. Let's go back to the old economy and focus on the balance sheet. So hard assets. We both kind of mentioned scarcity. So in a world today where nobody's been spending money for the better part of 20 years in things like energy sources, industrial metals, agriculture, land, certain types of infrastructure, there's not enough of it. There's not enough of it being produced. In some cases, you can't produce it at scale at the prices that require economic development, i.e. 10, 15, 20% cash on cash returns. So these are capacity constrained, they're scarcity. So if you can start with that hard asset as a cornerstone to your moat, and then overlay the business model analysis. So are there business models that are capital light that can actually get you exposure to those hard assets? We think that's a great place to start. And we're just starting a new secular era that's going to favor those types of companies over the incumbent stalwarts, which are really just platforms and advertising and things like that.
Yeah, and it seems like the latter doesn't actually add that much real economic value as some of these other ones. So maybe it's a good thing that capital starts flowing over to those companies, right? And James, I've heard you say this, I've heard other people say this, but basically that the last 30 years were an anomaly. And can you elaborate a little bit on what you mean by that, just in general?
Yeah. So if you, again, if you look at it from a purely top-down standpoint, so macroeconomic, there's been three enormous trends that have probably created an anomaly of the past 30 years, where, again, what do financial service people do? They look at the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. They put that in their spreadsheet. The past is an analog for the future, and that's what's going to happen again. But what if the last 30 years was the anomaly? So you had A, extremely high and consistently declining interest rates. So if you go back, I think it was 1983, the 10-year peaked around 18%. You know, that's a lot of tailwinds for basically everything to do well, bonds, stocks, houses, everything. If you go from 18 to the 2020 low, it's 50 bips on the 10-year. The other is that for a variety of reasons, that coincided with extremely low inflation, which allowed, I think, rates to be continuously declining. But what drove those low rates of inflation while government deficits and government spending was increasing? I think that was globalization. And these were more step function changes than recurring benefits. So one, globalization is inherently disinflationary. It's just efficiencies. You're getting products, materials, and labor from where it's abundant to where it's scarce. That in and of itself provides efficiencies. But then if you kind of drill down one step further, the West has really been importing disinflation in the form of cheap materials and cheap labor. Now that the developing world has a higher GDP per capita, i.e. a higher standard of living, they're competing with us for those same materials and that same labor. So now fast forward and look at profit margins and productivity. The last 20 years, the S&P 500 earnings per share grew around 9% a year. 500 basis points. So 500 basis points out of 900 was from profit margin expansion. Wow. A lot of that, I would argue, is productivity. So from 1999 through 2010, productivity grew about 3.2% a year, to 320 basis points. Go back to 99 through 2010. What was the step function change? The internet. We went from instant messaging and Netscape browsing to email and global commerce. So absent all of those tailwinds, something has to give here, where either rates have to go up, inflation's going to be higher, margins are going to come down. And I think the big one, the biggest variable that handcuffs the Fed is that I see no likelihood in Washington curtailing deficit spending. So we might be entering a new era where fiscal dominates monetary. So Powell can do whatever he wants with overnight rates. But if we're still running a $1 to $2 trillion deficit every year, and we have to fund that, the number one job of the central bank is to make sure the Treasury functions. So that's why we're looking at higher volatile inflation, higher volatile interest rates, and lower volatile profit margins going forward.
Yeah. So let's talk about the deficits, because the CBO came out with its budget projections for the next 10 years. And according to those projections, they expect, you know, $1.4 trillion in 2023 and an average of $2 trillion per year from 2024 to 2033. Which means the U.S. public debt will rise by $5.2 billion every single day for the next 10 years. I mean, when you hear that projection, what goes to your mind immediately, Preston? Like,
I mean, they were off by what, $500 billion? What was the number? In 3 months, it was twice as high than what their projection was 3 months ago. It was twice as high. Right. So what I get out of it is, I think whatever you think you understand about their projection is a fool's errand. Like, you, if you think you're trying to figure that out, that's a fool's errand.
Yeah.
Because it's just a total lie. I think that when we look at what they're going to be bringing in through just their tax revenues versus what their spending habits are, and rest assured, they have to spend at these levels. They have to acceleratively spend in order to facilitate enough dollars in the world. And so you have that idea combined with just these gross estimates of what they think it's going to be. And so I just look at the numbers and I just roll my eyes and I say, nobody has a clue what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. Because it's running away. And when you plot it and you look at how it's an exponential, it's not a linear in anyone's imagination. You can just look at the chart. You can see it's an exponential. And I don't think that they have any control over any of this. So, you know, we'll see. I think spending much time discussing what the level is going to be in 5 years from now is just a total waste of my time and everybody else's time, because I think it's a lie.
Yeah.
Hey, going back to this idea, we were talking about like valuations. So like when you just take the S&P 500 today, the S&P 500 is at a PE of 21. So what does that mean? Well, if you look at the price and you look at the earnings, the price, you're paying $21 to extract $1 of earnings out of that ratio, 21 to 1, PE of 21 to 1. So when you invert that and you go 1 divided by 21, what you get is a 4.7% return for owning the S&P 500. Okay. And this is just really rough ballpark numbers. 4.7% return. Now let's compare that to the 1 year treasury, which is currently at 5%. And you know what execution risk is associated with that 5%? Nothing. Mm-hmm. Right? So when we look at the S&P 500 and it's priced at 4.7% with tons of execution risk and whether they can retain their competitive moat for those 500 companies, and you're paying a discount of 0.3% or 30 basis points compared to the 1 year. I'm not talking 10 years or the 30 year, which is even lower. It really kind of paints a picture for somebody who's trying to wrap their head around the insanity that we currently face. And guess what? That 1 year treasury is increasing in yield. It's selling off, which is giving you even a higher yield. So that's the challenge. And that's why it's so confusing for everybody, because they're looking at this and they're saying, well, do I buy that? Or do I buy stocks that have some type of scarcity to them? Because if I buy this 1 year note, it's completely impacted by inflation. There's all sorts of things that are going on. The math is so jacked. And the reason that the math is so jacked is because you're dealing with a unit that is completely manipulated, with governments around the world that continue to step in and just willy-nilly print and hand stuff the money into whoever's hands, whether it's the big banks, which is pretty much where it's all gone. It's gone into the hands of all the big banks. They sprinkled a little bit of UBI over COVID And people thought that that was, you know, crazy. But relatively speaking, the amount that they shoved into the hands of the bankers over the past decade, the amount that they sprinkled into the hands of these people over UBI was literally laughable. It might have seemed like a lot, but it was laughable in contrast to the amount of QE and manipulation that they did sticking it into the hands of the bankers. So just some other ideas and why the math is just so jacked and the current situation that we're facing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just to going back to the CBO projections, they give you their assumptions and they're insane. So to Preston's point, it's tax receipts going up every single year for the next decade. So no recession. We are going to basically have inflation coming back down to two-ish within a year, 18 months. The average weighted coupon on the debt is going to be 4%. You're still running $1 trillion to $2 trillion deficits for every year for the next 10 years. So as illogical as that might seem at its face value, I think the craziest component is that they're saying all of that incremental debt is going to be funded by the public. So that means a third party borrower is going to willingly go out there and continue to finance this. And I know you guys are close with Lynn Alden. So hat tip to her where she tweeted this. And then I went and kind of dug up the data from the, I think it's the Budget Oversight Committee. But so they're projecting that the percentage of debt held by the public, I think, is going to get up to around 110% within a couple of years. So you hear about debt to GDP exceeding 100%, but in this case, what's held by the public, so not including what's being sterilized by the Fed, is going to increase 100% imminently, go to 110% within a couple of years. The only time that it's ever been remotely this close, I think, was 108% in 1942. Obviously, we had a pretty big reason to be lending the government money and a lot of rebuilding to do, and then had one of the largest surges in labor force participation and productivity on record, which then basically brought that rate back down to 20% in fairly short order. So again, when you audit that math, it's even more laughable.
Jeez.
What's frustrating, Sam, is like when you look at how they're spending money, right?
Yeah,
where it's going. And then you look at the infrastructure here in the US and how it's falling apart.
It's blowing up.
It makes you want to scream. It makes you want to scream because it's like, okay, so we're going to print billions and send it to this country and that country, and we're going to do all these things. But internally, we're like the capital investment. It's insane. I saw this video on Twitter of like this train kind of coming down this track in Ohio where they had the spill. And I mean, it literally looked like it was out of third world country. And it's like, okay, so we're making these capital investments everywhere else, but we can't make capital investments locally. And it's just, really frustrating.
Yeah. It's like what you said too. I mean, the tax receipts, Luke Roman just tweeted this. They were down 9.3% year over year in January, bringing them down 7% year over year for the 2023 year to date. And the interest payment alone on the debt is supposed to be over $850 billion in Q4 2022. So the spending, if the spending was aimed at long-term investment to increase productivity, enhancing infrastructure, research and development, that would have a deflationary effect, right? As long as productivity exceeds wage gains, then there's no inflationary impulse. But if the spending is just going to interest payments on existing debt or towards ever-growing entitlement programs, I mean, what's the end game there? It's a spiral.
There is no end game. The end game is hang on to your butts. Yeah, hang on to your butts and buy as much Bitcoin as you can because this is about to get crazy.
Or to James's point, like other hard assets could do well in that period as well too. And James, that's, you know, you guys have the Inflation Beneficiaries Fund. It's been doing really well since its inception. It's returned almost 14% annualized, well outperforming the S&P 500. You know, what's your strategy within that? Because I noticed there's all kinds of things. You mentioned agriculture, land. What's your overall strategy with that fund? Because I just found it really interesting. I think it's an interesting time to launch it. Obviously, you guys have this thesis of longer term inflation. What are some other ways to play that besides, like, as we know, Bitcoin, but other ways?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's things that are finite or somewhat finite in the ability for the supply side to respond. And that's why it's kind of comical in how the Fed is responding and trying to combat inflation, because everything they're doing is trying to reduce inflation by reducing demand. But to really, that's putting a Band-Aid on a patient that needs surgery. Surgery would be, we need more natural gas, we need more oil, we need more fertilizer, we need more arable land, we need a heck of a lot more copper if we're going to electrify the entire planet. And, you know, at this rate, we're going to electrify the entire way up to the moon. But copper mines take 15 years to do a greenfield copper mine and get it up to scale production. So the parallels with Bitcoin are obvious. There's scarcity, and with Bitcoin, obviously, there's a complete limit on supply. I mean, supply growth is fixed, and then obviously it's finite after a certain point, but there's parallels there in all of these hard asset markets. The problem with hard assets and the reason why you've seen capital withdrawn from these businesses is that they've been bad investments. So energy, copper, agriculture, to a lesser extent, land and infrastructure. Most of the commodity complex has been basically underwater since 2005, 2006. So all of these companies were expanding supply. People thought that, remember the BRICS miracle, where China and Russia and India were going to basically spur real growth of 5 to 7% a year forever. So they flooded the market. The market collapsed, and it's been basically a 15, 20 year down cycle. But they are inherently bad businesses, low return on assets, very cyclical profitability. So then what we look at is we try to find capital light businesses. So how do you get access to those types of assets with business models that have high profit margins, can scale? Ultimately, it's all about, can you grow revenue in nominal terms, so inflation adjusted terms, where your cost structure doesn't participate in that growth? So things like royalties in gold and iron ore and energy, financial exchanges, where, again, they're basically just toll booths on financial activity. And their volume, which drives their revenue, is very highly correlated to nominal GDP growth. So, again, it's finding that scarce asset, base, and then overlaying the quality business model so you can feel comfortable owning this and not having to worry about a CEO pitching the board, spending $3 billion to go dig a hole in the middle of God knows where, and then destroying your capital returns for the next decade.
Hey, Sam, sorry to backtrack a little bit, but we had brought up some points with the numbers there on how bad the Treasury has estimated their expenses here. So the U.S. Treasury needs to borrow $932 billion just in the first quarter of 2023. This is $349 billion more, which is 60% higher than they thought they would need to borrow last quarter. Just to give you the numbers.
Jeez. I mean, the projections get me too, because, you know, we feel like we're entering this decade that is more uncertain. There's more geopolitical tensions. You know, all of this debt problems that we see, and they expect that there won't be a recession, right, in the assumptions, and that there won't be some kind of major conflict, like hopefully not, but things are uncertain right now. And it just seems absolutely ludicrous to have those projections and not expect some kind of event that occurs that would require more, you know, debt issuance. And it's just silly.
I think you got to start with terminology, right? The word recession, right? I would argue there are tons of people, percentage-wise, I don't know what the percent would be, but it's a very high percentage in the United States right now that would tell you, I'm working two jobs, my wife's working a job, we only net an additional $100 with her working after we put the kids in childcare or whatever. So how do you define recession? How do you define just sheer economic pain for the common person who's just trying to stay alive, that's been working for 30 years of their life and they only have 40% paid off on their house? It doesn't make any sense. You could go out into the woods for 30 years and cut down trees and you have a damn mansion if you made it by yourself, right? So like, people aren't asking themselves like these really simple, basic, core ideas of if I work my tail off and I have nothing to show, I'm a debt slave. I'm a debt slave. And it's a function of this highly like manipulated system of how they're controlling the money, how they're inserting the money, how they're controlling interest rates. And because people aren't taught any of this stuff in school, they don't know any better. They just think it's normal because they've been dealing with it. They've been dealing with the slow grind decline in their ability to afford anything their whole lives. And so it's worn out. They don't even understand where they're at. So like, how would we even define recession when we're dealing with this juggernaut of reality that the common person is dealing with on a daily basis? Are we measuring it based off of the stock market that 1% of the global population pretty much owns all the equity of? Is that what we're basing it off of? Because yeah. If we are, like, we're so off the grid of reality for the everyday person that's participating in this economy.
Yeah, and the concept of moral hazard too, where go back to your PE multiple example on the S&P 500. I think there's an implicit assumption from everybody buying the S&P that if something horrible goes wrong, the bazooka comes right back out and they've got my back. They're not going to let it spiral. And I go to conferences, I see other kind of buy side investors, and you know, I'm on the younger side. I'm 39, but I see a lot of younger people than me in these rooms, and they just kind of have this mindset that if something bad happens, I'm going to get bailed out so I can take this risk that isn't really commensurate with the fundamentals. And, you know, by my background, I'm kind of unique, even though I'm younger for kind of being a PM, because one, my family's business was hospitality down at the New Jersey Shore. And as a really young kid, I saw my parents get the keys taken away on their businesses during the savings and loan crisis. So understanding if you're over-levered and you have a cash flow and duration mismatch, keys go away. It's funny. This is actually a funny story. I was talking to my boss and looking at buying a house after the pandemic, because I had to get out of New York City with little kids. And I said, you know, Peter, do you think it's reasonable? You get, you know, I know they have all these ratios of what they'll lend to you, but I think it's reasonable to have 10 years of mortgage payments in the bank is a reasonable buffer that you can afford that house. And he starts cracking up. He's like, James, nobody would buy a house. Are you out of your mind? But that moral hazard doesn't exist. Like all these people running around that started their career post 08. I was also, you know, very young at Horizon. I started in 05, saw the rug getting pulled out in 08. But everyone else who basically started or didn't have really a role where they were managing and exposed to risk before 08, they're just like, look, they've got my back. They're going to make everything better. I have nothing to worry about. So, and you see it where risk premium is priced.
Everybody's turned into Pavlov's dog. And they think that when, you know, the bell, when the market's starting to crash, it's like, where's the Fed? They're in a panic. Where's the Fed to save me? Right? We need the Fed to save us. Like, and they do, because if the Fed doesn't come in, if the Fed doesn't come in, everybody's effed.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, it's interesting because everybody, they look at the existing system and they say, well, this is how it has to be. This is how it has to be that this savior sweeps in and prints a bunch of money and jams it into the hands of the select few. And then whatever trickles down. That's for them to figure out. That's for the peasants to figure out. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. This has been normalized. This is what people think this is how they think the world should function and how it should go around. And what they fail to realize is that this is a form of debt slavery. Like you are not getting out of this. Like if you think you're going to work harder at the bottom of this and you know, if you have a startup and you're one of these 1% people that can create value for the first time that the big boys haven't already created a value stream and captured all that equity. Well, congratulations, because that is a really, really difficult thing to do in this type of environment at this point in time. Now, 20, 30 years ago, it was different. You had a lot more stability that was happening from a currency standpoint. But at the end of these really big credit cycles, the fitness required from an entrepreneur to outswim the current, the debasement current, is so unprecedented that I don't think people realize what they're up against when they're trying to do a startup without some type of massive venture capital entity stepping in and just funding the hell out of it.
Yeah. And like,
and even then their chances of success are very minimal.
Yeah. The interference in the free markets too. And if you just think about how a majority of innovation comes from those startups, you start to see the bigger problem. And James, you brought up productivity. That seems to be the key, right? Like if we could somehow have a productivity boom here, and I'm honestly, I guess I'm kind of an optimistic person, and I look around at some of the technologies just recently and thinking about how they could maybe converge to create some kind of productivity boom to help us get out of this problem. Do you think it's even possible though? I mean, it was kind of what we did after World War II and kind of helped us get out of that debt problem. But today we're in a different world, different economy. So what do you think about that? The odds of a productivity boom?
Yeah, look, I'm maybe a realistic optimist by nature, and I love capitalism. I love the United States. And I think that the ingenuity of what we can accomplish and have accomplished is unparalleled. But the math is just difficult because let's just assume Web3 or AI or one of these technologies creates this massive windfall of productivity. The problem is that that's probably going to come at the expense of labor. So the identities of GDP, labor force growth rate and productivity growth. So you saw a huge spike in productivity during the beginning of the pandemic when the labor force went down. So it's almost as if labor is going to be at the expense of productivity. And so if that's the formula, then it doesn't really get us anywhere. We're still kind of standing still. And so some incredible technologies that are going to change our lives and the world for the better, but I don't necessarily think that that translates into the ability to outgrow the debt burden and the structural issues in the economy today.
So Sam, we're talking about creative destruction. Mm-hmm. We're talking about for a free and open market to function, to actually function, you have to allow creative destruction to occur. And if you stop allowing creative destruction to occur, you are not going to live in an economic environment that is fair for people to compete openly. Yeah. Okay. So the ultimate tool that prevents creative destruction from happening is quantitative easing, followed by universal basic income. Those tools are the end of the road for a free and open functioning economy. Okay. So your question, looking at it from a positive standpoint, what actually provides creative destruction to an economy as it's going through this phase transition? It's a new form of money. It's a new form of money that actually has scarcity built into it that can't be manipulated. Because when it arrives, what it does is it takes the credit market that has been totally mutilated and manipulated for decades on end, and it smashes it with a sledgehammer. Okay, because all of that debt is denominated in fiat contracts that say this is what's going to be returned and repaid. So what brings the creative destruction is the obliteration of the credit market. And so who's sitting on all that credit? Who's sitting on all that buying power? Banks, treasuries of businesses that are, you know, not thinking critically about what economic unit they actually want to denominate their retained earnings in. And so I'm very optimistic for the general population of the world, because although there might be some pain and maybe this one step back to take two steps forward, what's about to be ushered in with sound, fair, saleable, scarce money that's instantly you can zap around the world with almost no frictional barrier. What that's going to mean for the world is unprecedented. It's going to take all this equity that's pent up and stuffed into the hands of the few, and it's going to pop it out like somebody fumbling a football. And guess what? There's going to be a lot of people that can recover that ball that are now going to actually have a chance to buy pennies on the dollar because they're performing economic calculation in a fair and open unit. So what technology is going to provide it? I think we all know exactly what technology is going to provide it. It's just a matter of time and for enough people to start figuring that out and realize how fair and open and free this new system is.
Hey, Preston, in that world, do you see the U.S. federal debt getting inflated away via debasement, or do you see a hard default? Kind of, where do you see the federal debt in that type of world and that type of transition?
I think it really comes down to the decision makers of the leaders of the country, each country, whether you're talking U.S. or whatever, and how much of a percentage they actually start stacking in this new currency. So if they start backing and they start stacking Bitcoin, it doesn't even have to be a high percent. Hell, at these prices, I would say they don't even need 1%. You know, as it goes higher, they're going to have a higher percentage. But their ability to offset that bleed that's going to naturally happen out of all their credit markets is going to be completely dependent on the amount of proportion that they're also adding of the new currency onto their treasury. And how quickly they can realize the transition with respect to their spending habits and getting that under control. So like here in the U.S., when you look at the defense budget and you look at all these other spending programs that exist and how far they're exceeding the actual capacity of the country from a tax standpoint, a reasonable tax standpoint, they're going to have to completely re-engineer the way that they spend money and what they hand out to the general public. And so I don't know that the general public is ready for that here in the U.S. And I don't think that they're all G7 countries, I don't think are prepared for that from just a cognitive standpoint, the cognitive conditioning standpoint over the last couple decades. And so I fully expect them to struggle with this transition the most relative to other, you know, smaller countries that have really kind of suffered quite a bit over the past couple decades due to dollar and euro and yen dominance. They're going to come out of this, I think, in a way better situation, and they're going to be able to be way more agile with the transition. And that's not, as an American, that's not what I want.
Yeah.
But that's what I think is most probable.
We're kind of seeing that too, right? So adoption rates in, say, Nigeria, and other places that have struggled more than G7 countries, that's where Bitcoin adoption is flourishing. And then El Salvador is like a case study, right? I mean, they're paying down their debts right now. I mean, say exactly what you want. I mean, they're like a little case study that's showing the world what's possible if you do adopt Bitcoin. And that's kind of how I look at them. And it's pretty crazy to see their success in a lot of ways over the last, since they adopted Bitcoin.
Sam, is these countries that have the control of the fiat, like if they could mentally figure it out, the leaders of these countries could figure it out. Like they have such an advantage because they got the power of the printing press to start stacking and putting this stuff on their balance sheet in a way that they don't have to broadcast it to the world. The biggest setback is the pure hubris that sits in the brain of these leaders, and that they think that this is impossible when many of us see it is inevitable.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge, is how do you overcome your hubris and your ego and everything else from a leadership standpoint from all these G7 countries. From what I'm seeing, you know, in the media, that's a pretty high hurdle for them to ever overcome.
I feel like hubris is a big blocker for a lot of people when it comes to Bitcoin. Ego,
yep.
Arrogance, and it works at the sovereign level too. But James, yep. You know, I've heard Murray's takes on Bitcoin, and I thought it was great. But I haven't really heard yours like in depth or anything. How do you view Bitcoin, and how does it fit into, let's say, your long-term inflationary thesis?
I kind of look at it through two ways. And a lot of my opinion admittedly has been formed by Murray, where, you know, I'll raise my hand where I was that hubristic, you know, young man who, when I first heard of Bitcoin, that it was like, all right, what is this nonsense? And then when Murray first brought it up in our investment committee, I think it was 2015, maybe 2014, I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe he's talking about this. But luckily I have enough humility and respect for Murray and Peter and Steve to be like, all right, I got to go read this thing. I read the white paper. I'm like, all right, shit, I don't understand this thing. I got to, you know, take a bunch of steps back and then really understand it. And then just read everything I get my hands on to listen to people that I knew really knew what they were talking about. And so I look at it through two different lenses. One, which is Preston's, which is that it's finite and everything else in the world is being debased. The fiat system is being debased and you need a finite store of value. Basically every fiat currency throughout history has eventually gone to zero. You know, one of the best case studies is the Roman denarius, where they started cutting it more and more with base metals, and kind of removing that precious metal and that value content. So, you know, I think that's very easy and intuitive. And in a world where you want that and need that store of value, that's, I think, the easier lens. The other side, which I struggle with because I don't come from a computer programming background or a technology background, but we talked about what could increase productivity and what could help economically. But think about the blockchain and how many of these entrenched systems have their hand in the cookie jar, kind of taking out fees. And I think one of the best examples is credit cards. So 3% swipe fees, where that can really be almost completely done through a blockchain technology. In stock market, believe it or not, stocks still require 2 to 3 days to actually settle in your account. It's 2023, and that actually technically is not your property in your account for 3 days. Title insurance, yeah. Insurance, like all of this record keeping. And so that's the side where I'm like, wow, there's actually a lot of potential to this technology behind the other also very attractive kind of immutable, finite type of store of value component. And so when you bring those two together, I think, and that's kind of how Murray looks at it, is where you can get really excited if you appreciate both prongs of that view.
Yeah. And that's what Bitcoin, I mean, that immutable base layer can allow those functions with layers built on top of it. I mean, you brought up Web3. I'm already moving to Web5, man. I don't know if you heard about that, but Preston, I feel like lately you've been really going deeper. I don't know, man. It just seems like from the outside, you're just like, I'm done with these centralized things. I'm going all decentralization. I mean, you've been over on the Noster?
I don't know which one it is.
Yeah, okay. I like them both. But you've been over at Noster, which is a decentralized communications protocol that implements Lightning into it. Lightning's the second layer payment layer on top of Bitcoin payment protocol. And the thing is about Bitcoin is it has these properties of a monetary good like gold or, you know, a store of value and all that, a digital hard money. But it's also a technology with the upside, the asymmetric opportunity of, say, like a emerging tech stock or something. That's why it makes it so attractive. And so what are you seeing on the Bitcoin innovation front, Preston? Because I feel like it's accelerated pretty rapidly over the last year or so.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the Noster thing is way bigger than people realize. I like to observe nature, and nature loves to find the most efficient way to move energy, and it's very symbiotic, right? And so whenever I look at Bitcoin, when I look at a decentralized communications protocol that can't be manipulated, like Twitter or Facebook or all these other ones that clearly are manipulated. And if you don't believe me, go to Noster for a couple of weeks and follow the same people that you're following on Twitter or wherever. And you're going to be blown away at the difference between your feed on Noster and your feed on Twitter. In addition to just the ability to communicate in a free and open way that's uncensorable, combining that with Bitcoin and Bitcoin layer two that has this frictionless element. So like if I want to send you 5 sats and I just log on to Noster and I just click one button and then a second button and you get the 5 sats and it's settled immediately. It's not real hard to figure out that technology is revolutionary in efficiencies to what we have today. That you got the full amount, that you got an amount that's less than a penny, and you got the full amount.
and you got it instantly. And you don't have to expose who you even are. And there's nothing anybody can do about it. So when I look at that situation and I look at the technology growth in those areas, it's not hard for me to pay attention to it because I'm just looking at the opportunity cost of where else you could be, like Twitter or whatever, and then using ACH or whatever. And I'm just like, this is just laughable. It's laughable that anybody thinks that this is not going to work or that this isn't going to be the solution in the long term when you're comparing it to the existing legacy systems that everybody's using for these things. When I look at the end of a credit cycle and what historically plays out, one of the most important things for these existing governments is the control of media and the control of speech and the control of ideas. And so I think what we've seen with respect to COVID, what we've seen in all sorts of like highly contentious areas of debate and how social media platforms have become a weapon of government control all over the world, not just in any particular domain, but all over the world. How can anybody think that Nostr isn't going to usurp all of that power and energy out of these existing systems? Like, this is laughable to me. And then you're combining it with the incentive that people can get zapped with 5 sats or 10,000 sats or 1,000,000 sats instantly for content that they create. I'm just looking at like major content creators. Like, could you imagine if Mr. Beast went onto a platform like Nostr where people can literally, instead of hitting them with a like, which is meaningless, they can hit them with actual proof of work energy units like Satoshis with no frictional barrier instantly. Like, people haven't done the math on the incentive structure there. And, you know, I think within a year to 3 years, it's going to blow people's minds. The mass movement over to a protocol like that.
It's a shame because you guys obviously are much deeper in this stuff than I am, but you see all of the great progress, all of the great innovation, and the bad actors who had startups within the crypto industry, they get all the headlines, they get all the congressional hearings, they get the front page articles. And I don't know if it comes back to hubris or if there was malintent from day one, but you know, we're all mathematically inclined. And I don't like, as I alluded to before, I don't like leverage on my house. I would not lever crypto exposure 1%. And then you have these people out there that were running, you know, 20 turns of leverage on crypto. You had other that were just running outright kind of shell frauds where they were speculating through trading arms. I'd love to know the psychology of what was going through their minds, and I think it definitely set things back. But it's obscuring all of these other things that are just such positive developments.
It's a lot of noise, in the crypto. That's why we try to delineate the differences between Bitcoin and broader crypto. You know, you guys are two value guys, and you know, the Bitcoin only realm is kind of like the value investor space. And you know, people are focused on the utility and not the speculation and the craziness. And that's how I kind of see Bitcoin only. And, you know, I think eventually the truth comes to the top. Yeah, that's why like my CEO, like Corey, is really adamant about calling out these crypto scams, because he's worried about it kind of setting back adoption or delaying adoption. And he thinks this is kind of a race, to bring a Bitcoin to as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, before they continue to debase the currencies. And if cryptos more broadly are delaying that adoption, well, it's actually hurting everyday people in the end. So I think you make a good point. And I think it's just about getting the messaging out and just building tools that speak for themselves, like Nostr. I mean, it's hard to use that and not say, wow, this is really something special. And this is going to change a lot of things, especially when you look at the censorship happening on these social media platforms and elsewhere. So I think you make a good point, James. I think it's just about getting the truth out there and continuing to push the message that Bitcoin isn't crypto, and that there's real innovation here and proof of work.
And the innovation is Bitcoin. It's not any of these other cryptocurrencies. I don't know if you have anything
people,
to add, Preston.
People fail. Yeah, I would just say people fail to think critically. And people fail to, and some of that is internal. So like if you're a total taker and parasite type person, you're going to have a really hard time identifying where there's value, like for the masses. Because you, as a parasite, a person will think that when they stand up token XYZ and they pre-mine 70% of it, and then they use a lot of that pre-mine to go out and conduct marketing, and they actually control the underlying protocol itself, and it's actually not decentralized, that person's a parasite. That person just did an equity offering, right? And they just circumnavigated the SEC and did it in an illegal way. So is that person going to be somebody who has a breakthrough technology in a decentralized kind of way that's bringing sound and open money to the world? Of course not. So a person who's a parasite is going to have a very hard time seeing these things. But a person who's let's look at Fiat Jeff, the guy who created the Nostr protocol, right? He didn't issue a token with this. He wrote the code. He did all the hard work. He did the proof of work to write the code. He then put it out there, and then people just started using it. And like, what was his kickback? It was nothing. It was a gift to the world. So those are the people that I like to look for and that I like to try to find, because those are the givers. Those aren't the parasites. And those are the people that are going to create efficiencies for energy exchange, which is whether it's communication, whether it's money or whatever. And, you know, I think that's how you can quickly and easily identify the scams and the noise from the signal.
You bring up a really good point that I don't want to forget to bring up. But if you look at who has gotten into crypto, who has favored Bitcoin and then other protocols, there was a big wave of really intelligent people, probably the biggest names. They were all part of this big global macro crowd, kind of the ex-fortress global macro guys. And some of them I respect immensely. They saw liquidity coming in, an outlet for liquidity, and to some of them, it didn't really matter. Is it Bitcoin that's a finite supply where you can actually have math support the thesis, or is it, you know, Terra and other stuff where it's just like enough liquidity in the system, it's going to find an outlet. I like the chart. The chart shows me that based on all these little squiggly lines I draw on there, it's going to keep going up. And, you know, they obviously had a pretty bad experience. But that global macro crowd, they're trend following, they're looking at liquidity, they're looking at very different things from Preston and Horizon that want to basically reconcile that to a value equation. And so when you see that other, and I've seen plenty of people kind of in the long short space of more traditional value investors, almost without fail, that crew leans towards a Bitcoin only type of world because A, they can't reconcile unlimited issuance, and B, they recognize the incentives where somebody, you know, pre-mines 60% and then it's basically a marketing game. Market it and then get your rent and then dump it and then you're rich. So I think that's a big differentiation, the global macro trend following liquidity crowd and then the actual value crowd, because those two groups of investors think very differently.
And it's important to also note that when people are investing other people's money, they just got to keep up with whatever the major indexes are, right? So they're looking at it and they're saying, well, this isn't my money. I'm a GP and I'm sucking my 2% fee off of the 100 million or 500 million that came through the door. And I just have to get it right enough. But when a person's investing their own money and their own proof of work, retained earnings and energy, they tend to really want to be right about it and kind of crush it out of the ballpark. So I think you have a little bit of that going on, not for everybody, but for quite a few. I would say the base majority of money managers, they want to get the money out the door. They want to raise their next round. They want to get it's a statistics problem for them. If I throw enough at where the flows are going, I'm going to probably be right on a few of them. And just as long as I was close to hitting the mark on whatever index, you know, their investors would be measuring them against, If they can outperform by a couple percent, then they're going to continue to keep their Rolodex open for those same investors on the next round. And I think that's their math. I think that's the way they view the world, where I don't look at the world that way personally, just me personally. I want the greatest good for the most amount of people in the most efficient and economic way possible. And I want to try to educate them as much as possible, because that's my business, which is education and media. And you know, push out the noise. So it's incentives, right? It's the person's incentives. You got to look at where they sit and what their incentives are. And, you know, if they're wrong on a couple of them, it's no big deal, because they invested across the swath of, call it 10 to 50 different companies, or, you know, or should we call them protocols? But I think that's what's going on in some of those situations.
Yeah. And you want a monetary good that actually holds its value over time. That's another one. So these bear markets, usually Bitcoin shines every time, because all these other ones get wiped out. And if you look at these 4-year cycles, there's only like a handful, maybe the 3 or 4 alts that make a second all-time high against Bitcoin from these cycle to cycle. And Bitcoin just continues to stay on top. And that's what, James, what it does.
I can't speak for other people, but I know for myself, whenever I would see any token out there, the very first question I'd always ask myself is it actually decentralized? Because if it's not, why the hell do you need a blockchain, which is very inefficient, to do whatever the hell it's doing, right? Like, it was dead on arrival as soon as you asked that question for every single one of them, because none of them were actually decentralized. And if they're not decentralized, then you're going to have a G7 country step in and clobber it, right? It's going to murder it, because they have so much technical expertise and resources to clobber it, because they don't need a competitor in the space. So yeah, I don't know. There's people out there that'll try to make the argument, oh, well, you know, Ethereum or this or that it's decentralized enough, right? I don't think they realize what they're up against when it comes to state actors and their desire to control monetary units.
And what destroys fiat? Ultimately, it's money supply growth debasing the money stock itself. And another way to approach it is there a finite supply or any type of guardrails around? If the answer is no, it almost definitely means that it is not decentralized, and it means it's probably something that we're not interested in.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, guys, you guys have both been generous with your time. I could keep talking with you guys for a long, long time. It's been great. Where can people find you? James, I know that Horizon Kinetics has excellent research on the website. I've been reading it for years. But where can they find you specifically?
Yeah, so horizonkinetics.com. You can find the fund that I co-manage, the Inflation Beneficiaries Fund, is kind of right on the landing page. We're also, as you mentioned, pretty generous with our research. There's a paid portion, but we put a lot out there for free. We tweet out some interesting things as well under Horizon Kinetics Twitter handle. So also, you know, it's pretty easy to find how to get in touch with us, phone, email, et cetera. And, you know, shoot us a line if you'd like to talk about things anymore.
Preston?
Over at the Investors Podcast Network. I specifically host the Bitcoin show. We cover all sorts of anything finance related, investing related. We have a show for it. We have some awesome guests. Like recently we had Ray Dalio on a show, even though I don't agree with Ray when it comes to Bitcoin positioning. We have people like him. We've had Tony Robbins. We've had some amazing guests through the years. And obviously I've been lucky enough to get some really amazing Bitcoiners on the Bitcoin specific show. So the Bitcoin one comes out on Wednesdays, and we'd love to have you as a listener over there. And I'm active on Twitter.
And Noster.
And Noster, yeah.
And Noster, yeah. James, we got to get you on Noster, man. We could get you on there.
I don't like social media, but maybe I'll make an exception for that one.
That's fair.
You're smart.
That's fair.
You're smart,
yeah, you're smart.
Stay off of it.
you got good mental health over there.
No, you know what? I was the last one to adopt when everyone was doing it. It kind of, I think Facebook came out my senior year of college, and I was like, no way, I'm not doing this nonsense. And then like 6 years out, everybody was still staying in touch across the country, across the world. So I did it. I never posted. I hated it. And then when the pandemic hit and everybody's posting all this just Bitcoin term FUD, I was just like, done. Never again. Done. Forget it. I was like, where are the ESG people with the S in terms of this stuff?
I love it. Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate you guys coming on Swan Signal. Have to get you on again sometime and just have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thanks, Sam. Nice meeting you, James.
Likewise.
If you care about your financial future, you need to check out a couple of our offerings, including Swan IRA and Swan Private. Swan Private is our white glove concierge service where you get a trusted partner on your Bitcoin journey. We offer all kinds of education and research projects, as well as exclusive events to our Swan Private customers. Check it out today at swan.com/private. Also, Swan IRA. Swan IRA is the best way to gain exposure to real Bitcoin in a tax advantage account, like a traditional IRA, a Roth IRA, or rolling over your 401k. So if that interests you, check it out at swan.com/IRA today.